Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation magazine and author, who discusses the role corporate media has played in boosting public support for Donald Trump's divisive presidential candidacy. Christopher Viles, Director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut, who explains why he believes GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump is part of America's dark fascist tradition. And filmmaker Josh Fox, who talks about his new documentary titled How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, and his national tour connecting with grassroots groups fighting the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
China's dramatic economic slowdown has shocked global markets and put the jobs of industrial workers at risk. Falling demand for coal and steel has produced overcapacity in Chinese industries. 3 million jobs could be lost in China's state-run steel and iron factories. China's industrial overcapacity is the result of misreading the global markets for coal and steel. The plan for massive supply-side industrial restructuring is reminiscent of the move in the early 1990s to close state-owned iron and steel plants, which laid off tens of millions of Chinese workers. China has announced a new $15 billion plan to re-employ displaced industrial workers. Overall, China looks to create 10 million new jobs in line with declining growth forecasts. The prospects for workers who lose their jobs today are much more varied than those in the 1990s. The state-owned sector of the economy, which once was dominant, hires only 30% of the workforce today and only 10% of the manufacturing workforce. Brazil's swarming corruption scandal involving the state oil company Petrobras, big contractors and the ruling Workers' Party, has now reached former popular two-term President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known as Lula. In early March, prosecutors reached a plea deal with the Speaker of Brazil's lower house of Congress for accepting bribes in connection to a deal with Petrobras for building oil-rigged ships. Days later, a court sentenced the head of Brazil's biggest construction company to 19 years in jail for corruption and money laundering. Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff has been dogged by a slumping economy and an impeachment drive by conservative opponents who charged that she had cooked the books in the run-up to the 2014 presidential election. On March the 4th, prosecutors questioned Lula on allegations of money laundering involving a vacation home and a construction company. But Lula denied any wrongdoing. When President Rousseff sought to appoint the former president as her chief of staff, the move was seen as a way to immunize Lula from prosecution. The Brazilian Supreme Court responded by blocking the appointment, which Lula has appealed. Amid large anti-government and pro-government street protests, President Rousseff has charged that the allegations of corruption are baseless and a part of a coup attempt to remove her from office, orchestrated by her political enemies. On primary night in Ohio and Illinois, activists aligned with the Black Lives Matter movement scored big wins, as top prosecutors in Chicago and Cleveland suffered election defeats due to controversy over the police killings of young blacks. In Cook County, Illinois, challenger Kim Fox, an African-American prosecutor, thrashed two-term incumbent state's attorney Anita Alvarez. Alvarez was the focus of protests after the release of a video recording showing the police shooting of Laquan McDonald, who was shot 16 times by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. Alvarez infuriated activists by delaying the release of the video for 1 year. In Cleveland, challenger Michael O'Malley, a former county prosecutor, defeated incumbent Cuyahoga County prosecutor Timothy McGinty. In late 2014, McGinty led a grand jury investigation into the police killing of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old African-American boy who was shot while playing with a toy gun in a public park. McGinty declined to file charges against the police officer who had shot Rice only seconds after arriving on the scene. On election night, O'Malley called for calm in Cleveland and pledged to rebuild the confidence in the criminal justice system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Within minutes after reports of the latest terrorist bombings that killed and maimed dozens in Brussels, Belgium on March 22nd, U.S. corporate news media gave precious airtime in the midst of the crisis to Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, whose strong suit is appealing to racism and fear, not communicating the vital issues involved in effectively combating terrorism or skillfully executing foreign policy. The Pavlovian media response after the Brussels terrorist attack is but one recent example of how commercial media outlets, especially network and cable TV news, have lavished hundreds of millions of dollars of free airtime on the reality TV star turned presidential candidate. Of course, the media corporation's interest in featuring Trump on their programs has everything to do with ratings. Trump, who is much criticized for his bombast, but is unarguably media savvy, knows that his controversial and often toxic rhetoric generate public interest, much like drivers craning their necks to see a car accident on the side of the road. Powerful CBS CEO Les Moonves declared at a February 29th Morgan Stanley Investors Conference, quote, "Who would have thought that this Republican political circus would come to town? It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS," unquote. A recent study by the New York Times found Trump has received nearly $1.9 billion in free media in comparison to Hillary Clinton, who benefited from $746 million of free media, and Bernie Sanders, who trailed with $321 million. Your reporter spoke with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine and author, who discusses the role corporate media has played in boosting public support for Donald Trump's divisive presidential candidacy and the future of Bernie Sanders' progressive campaign.
We should never, ever lose sight of the overwhelming role that major media in this country has played in inflating Trump into something much bigger than he would have been. He might well have been a significant phenomenon this year. I'm not underestimating that. But I have been shocked and horrified by the way in which media in this country has neglected all other candidates, Republicans and Democrats, in order to give wall-to-wall coverage to Trump.
Well said, John. And there's some graphs that actually catalog the time, the broadcast time on network and cable TV news shows that Trump gets gratis, free, comparing it with the other candidates, as you said. In many cases, the numbers are exponentially greater for Trump than they are for other candidates, including an important candidate like Bernie Sanders.
Well, there's a very good example. At the end of 2015, the Tyndall Report, which really analyzes broadcast news, came up with an analysis of how all the stations had covered, how all the networks had covered the race. And to use one example, ABC Evening News devoted 80 minutes of coverage to clearly Trump-related stories, stories that really were about Trump. They devoted 1 minute to Bernie Sanders. Now, that sounds bad, right? It turns out the minute for Bernie Sanders was rounded up, and it was only 20 seconds.
Oh, my God.
So when you really do the math, ABC Evening News was covering Trump at a rate of 240-1 over Bernie Sanders, at a point when the two of them had almost exactly the same poll number. Now, you tell me what the play out of that is. The play out of that is that though each of them had a relatively equal level of appeal within their parties, one of them got 240 times the level of coverage. And ultimately, which one of them is now the front runner, right? I mean, this is not rocket science. This is not a complicated thing to figure out. I don't expect media to give perfectly equal coverage to everybody. I don't think it should. I think some candidates are more interesting, some are less. I happen to believe Bernie Sanders is actually more interesting than Donald Trump in a lot of ways, but you know, people can make their call on that, and I respect that. That is what journalism is. You interpret, you take a look, you say this is more important than that. But it's never, ever a 240-1 ratio. That's what has happened. What our media has done is grossly irresponsible. And it has been done not because of some conspiracy. It's not because people love Donald Trump. That's not it. It's because our consolidated bloated major media is now so obsessed with ratings and clicks online that it covers the easiest, simplest story, and Trump is smart enough to make himself the easiest, simplest story.
Bernie Sanders, is he finished in terms of the nomination? And is there a possibility that Bernie Sanders' movement, populated by a very enthusiastic group of young people, millennials, who see dim prospects for their future and looking for dramatic change, is it possible that Bernie Sanders' very exciting political campaign, if it does not emerge victorious, will transform, will morph into a new progressive movement across the country?
You know, those who want to shut this process down and you know, kind of move on to the November race, I think they're just going to have to wait, because the fact of the matter is it appears that in all these states that have yet to vote, people are very excited about mounting a Bernie Sanders or, you know, a dissident politics. Now, ultimately, this will grow beyond Sanders. It has to. Politics should never be about an individual. It always has to be about more. But at this point, you've got a candidate who's going out there and raising a lot of these issues and drawing huge crowds, winning primaries, winning caucuses, probably will win some more as we go along here. That ultimately can and must translate into the next politics, not just of the Democratic Party, but of the country. Because, you know, I know people like to get in their narrow partisan ruts, but the fundamental reality is we have so many issues that we have not addressed for so long that, you know, when somebody comes along talking about a political revolution, our media elites ought to pause and say, why does this so excite folks? Why does this connect so well politically against such odds? The answer is people really do want a different politics. And I do think that out of what's happening this year, people will necessarily build a different, more radical politics on the left.
That was John Nichols, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine and author of the new book co-written with Robert McChesney titled People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to find links to more analysis of media's role in covering the 2016 election campaign. While Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's racist and xenophobic rhetoric delivered at his large rallies have triggered condemnation and protest across the U.S., escalating violence directed at protesters who have attended his events in recent weeks have raised alarm. Trump supporters have been videotaped punching, kicking, and spitting at peaceful protesters who expressed opposition to the front-running GOP candidate. When asked about the documented behavior of his supporters, Trump has refused to condemn the violence at his events or express regret for the numerous times he's explicitly advocated physically attacking individuals who disrupt his rallies. Further, Trump defended his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, who has been observed roughing up an anti-Trump activist and a conservative reporter. The threat of clashes between Trump supporters and opponents caused the campaign to cancel one rally in Chicago on March 11th. As the Republican Party establishment openly discussed organizing efforts to block Trump's nomination at their summer convention, the billionaire real estate developer made the implicit threat that his supporters may be angry enough to riot. Your reporter spoke with Christopher Viles, director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut, and author of the book Haunted by Hitler, Liberals, the Left, and the Fight Against Fascism in the U.S. Here, Professor Viles explains why he believes Donald Trump is part of America's dark fascist tradition.
First of all, I guess I'd like to say that Trump is, he's not a fully developed fascist in my view, but I would say he's far enough down that road that if you were to call him an actual fascist or the fascist candidate, you wouldn't really be wrong. And I say that because Trump basically, I mean, it's important to remember what fascism really is. And in my book, I argue that it has been a part of American life since the 1920s, and it's palpably impacted American democracy. And so Trump, in certain ways, or at least the fascist tradition, did not begin with Trump in the United States. But he does bring it to a new visibility and a new level of danger. I mean, but for starters, I mean, fascism is not so much driven by economics or economic appeals. You know, people who are drawn to kind of fascist appeals or the fascist message is more an emphasis on kind of strength, power, leadership, violence, nation, race. And its kind of core features are militarism or male violence, hard rejection of equality, anti-intellectualism, a disregard for constitutional democracy, racism, all of these things. So, I mean, I guess I see Trump as belonging at least to the fascist tradition, or at least being a fascist-minded politician, because though he has an economic platform, it's not really his emphasis. His emphasis is that language of strength, power, race, violence. He's also very authoritarian. He kind of personifies the strong man who wants to get things done without obeying the usual protocol. He's drawn to other strong men like Putin and even North Korea's Kim Jong-un. And, you know, and that's also the street-level racial violence that he basically brings out in his supporters and he condones. It's not really too much of a surprise to me that organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and Stormfront and overtly pro-fascist groups are kind of drawn to his message.
Professor Viles, there have been commentators who declare that Donald Trump is a creation of the Republican Party that was born out of the backlash that the party took advantage of among white voters against the civil rights movement when it emerged in the late 50s and 1960s. And over the decades, the Republican Party has engaged what many describe as dog whistle politics, appealing to white voters' racism in subtle and not so subtle ways over the years. You can see pretty clearly that there are links between the Republican Party's recent history and the popularity of Donald Trump. I'm not sure if you agree or disagree, but I thought I'd throw that out there for comment.
No, I actually completely agree with that. And in fact, you were talking about that Trump kind of grows out of this kind of racial backlash or this, you know, in certain ways, you know, what we might call the Southern strategy of the late 60s or the early 70s in this particular racial strand of Republican rhetoric. And I completely agree with that. In fact, in my book, I argue that George Wallace basically is also one of those kind of rare politicians that I would place in an American fascist tradition. And he was actually acknowledged as such even by William F. Buckley at the time. But, you know, Wallace is, you know, the candidate, third party candidate in 1968, 1972, he really is the kind of progenitor of this particular kind of coded racial message of white racial resentment that comes out of and gets co-opted by the mainstream Republican Party by Nixon, you know, in 68 and 72, and it kind of carries forward from then. But I mean, I think these dark currents of American life basically have really impacted American politics at a number of critical junctures. And, you know, time will tell if we're at one of those junctures right now.
Professor Viles, relate to our listeners, if you would, the best way you can recommend that fascist and racist and scapegoatist ideology in U.S. politics can be effectively combated.
I guess the good news is that these kind of fascist types and these fascist figures have really been checked by a pretty vigorous anti-fascist tradition in American life. And this is pretty much ordinary people just getting involved, ordinary people forming social movements, you know, either anti-racist movements or movements for tolerance or kind of anti-homophobic movements. If ordinary people do not want to see a Trump or kind of a fascist figure, the way to, and I know we're all really busy, but the way to really check that is to get involved with grassroots movements at the local level. Because short of that, just the president itself or the Democratic Party itself left to its own devices is not, or certainly not the Republican establishment, it's just not going to stop this on its own.
That was Professor Christopher Viles, Director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut and author of the book Haunted by Hitler: Liberals, the Left, and the Fight Against Fascism in the U.S. Find more views and analysis of Trump's presidential campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
a coalition of groups called the Sugar Shack Alliance, which opposes construction of a frack gas pipeline through western Massachusetts, held a four-day, 53-mile protest walk, March 17th through the 20th, through several of the small towns that would be in the pipeline's path. The pipeline, called the Northeast Energy Direct, is being proposed by the Tennessee Gas Pipeline Company, whose parent corporation is Kinder Morgan. Its application for construction must be approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, by granting a so-called Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity. On the first night of the walk, 400 people attended the screening of documentary filmmaker Josh Fox's new film, titled How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. The event was part of Fox's Let Go and Love tour, in which the filmmaker brings his documentary to communities fighting their own battles against fossil fuel companies that exacerbate climate change. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who covered the protest walk, spoke with Josh Fox about his new film before the screening.
This is a movie about climate change. It's really the third and final chapter of the trilogy of environmental films that starts with Gasland 1 and Gasland 2. But this film is much broader and bigger focus than just fracking. So it was a film that started out being about climate change and the climate crisis. Because when you're working on fossil fuels, this is what happens. You end up with the climate over and over again because it is the greatest problem that the world has ever known, and it's primarily fossil fuels that are responsible for it. So this movie, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, is really in sort of two halves, the How to Let Go of the World half and the Love All the Things Climate Can't Change half. It acknowledges how late we are to act right now. I mean, James Hansen went in front of the Congress as a representative of NASA and told us all in 1988 that we were warming the Earth. That would have been the moment to start working on this in a huge way. We are now, 28 years later, we are in deep, deep trouble with respect to the climate, and many of the things that we acknowledge as some of the worst aspects of climate change, we're too late to stop. When we talk about how much we've already warmed the Earth, when we talk about how all the things that are frozen on Earth right now that we need to stay frozen are melting, that the sea levels will rise, that extreme weather gets worse and worse as the atmosphere warms. We're talking about letting go of the world that we live in now, which is this world based on greed and competition and violence. Climate is going to rewrite the coastal maps. We're going to lose a lot of our coastal cities. We're going to lose 30 to 50% of the species on the planet. These are incredibly difficult things to encounter. What we need going forward are the things climate can't change. Those are our civic values. Those are human rights, democracy, community, love, generosity, respect, creativity, innovation. These are the things that climate can't change. So I think when you see the film, you'll understand the pit of despair that I went through in making the first part of the film, and then the heights of inspiration that come from meeting all these amazing people all across the Earth. The film travels to 6 continents, 12 different countries, and to meet just absolutely extraordinary people who embody those values and those virtues that are the things that climate can't change that we need to start to base the next phase of civilization on.
You're doing this tour and going to places like you're in Ashfield, Massachusetts right now, which is there's a walk going on to protest a frack gas pipeline here. And I know you're doing that with a lot of other places. Just say a little bit about your tour.
Yeah, we're in the middle of what's called the Let Go and Love tour for How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. That is a fundamental part of our distribution model. Yes, the film will be on HBO at the end of June. Yes, it will go into theaters for Earth Week and around Earth Day in New York and LA and other places. But hallmark of our strategy is to work directly with communities that are on the ground that are fighting fossil fuel infrastructure. For Gasland and Gasland 2, that was the fracking fight. For the climate movie, that's every fight. And that's pipelines, compressor stations, power plants, LNG terminals, coal, tar sands, frack gas, frack oil, offshore drilling, onshore drilling, all of these ways in which the fossil fuel industry is actually expanding at a time when we know we have to move away from fossil fuels. So something like the NED pipeline, which you're all marching against, this is unacceptable. And so is the Constitution pipeline and the AIM pipeline and the Pilgrim pipelines and the bomb trains. We have to start to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, and we have to do it immediately. We can't use natural gas as a bridge. We know that that will bring us way past where we need to be in this worsening climate crisis. So when we're talking about the tour, it's going directly to communities who are fighting fossil fuels. So we're premiering this movie literally in the middle of a protest. This is day one of your 50-mile march over 4 days. We couldn't be happier to be doing the movie in this context.
The day after Josh Fox's film screening, 100 walkers arrived at the spot where pipeline opponent and landowner Larry Sheehan encouraged his friend Will Elwell to build a full-size replica of Henry David Thoreau's Walden Pond cabin, right in the path of the pipeline. Larry Sheehan briefly spoke to the protest walkers at the site of the Thoreau cabin.
When my wife Carol and I bought this old farm over 20 years ago, we were asked to sign a covenant to the title that forbade us from building anything new on these 11 or so acres that we have. The idea was to preserve open space and the rural character of the neighborhood, and we were happy to agree. So then a couple of years ago, Tennessee Pipeline came calling with their own plans for our backyard, and we were shocked, of course. It felt like we were betrayed. We were heartbroken, really, and I'm sure many, many others have felt the same way. So when Will, my friend Will Elwell, came over and said, can he build a replica of the Thoreau cabin here? I said, sure. And here we have it. It's a small but sturdy little edifice. It's strong because it's more than the sum of its posts and beams. It really represents the will of the people.
That was Western Massachusetts frack gas pipeline opponent Larry Sheehan and filmmaker Josh Fox. For more information on Josh Fox's new film, in opposition to Kinder Morgan's proposed Northeast Energy Direct Frack Gas Pipeline, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.